This is episode zero of All the Pieces Matter. It's a news and discussion show about Baltimore and the people working to change it for the better. I'm Andrew Hazlett, and I'm joined by
Sharon Paley.
And today we're also joined by our special guest, Mr. Hasdai Westbrook.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, we're going to just dive right in, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about Hasdai and his interesting activities and background and evil schemes. But we have a few bits of news to share. As you may know, and a very tiny percentage of you may have participated in, this past Tuesday was the primary election in Baltimore and the rest of Maryland.
It was a tiny percentage because I think I saw that only 16% of the city voted in the primary.
That's a shame.
Which is even lower than the last time, which I couldn't imagine it could go lower than the last time.
And what's really depressing is that it's the one like city election that actually counts because of the disenfranchisement of other members of other parties, Green, Republican, Libertarian, etc.
What are those things?
I don't know. They're not permitted.
Yeah, well, I mean, I actually a couple of years ago became a U.S. citizen.
I'm
from London, for those who don't know. They had this woman from the League of Women Voters who was very impressive but absolutely terrifying, and she scared the bejesus out of us and basically said, do not register as an independent, which is what I would have done. You register as for a party, otherwise you have no say in this city or this state. And I'm like, all right. So we all kind of immediately went and registered as Democrats.
I guess there's an opportunity for the parties to decide that they would have open primaries.
Sure.
And maybe the GOP would look into that because it is such a one-party state, city, all the way down the line.
What I heard is that it is up to the parties to open or keep their primaries closed. And, you know, the Democratic Party really doesn't have much incentive to do that.
Right, it would have to be a mutual thing. Otherwise, it's completely just to the party's disadvantage to open up their primary, right?
Yeah.
If only one of them does it.
Now, I think, it's de facto exclusion from, you know, voting for many Marylanders. So I think the ACLU or somebody ought to challenge it, along with the heavily gerrymandered districts that result in such non-competitive elections. But those are that's strictly speaking for myself and no one else. But anyway, we've got some other interesting news that maybe is not quite as depressing when all of the same people got reelected. Well, there's some interesting sidelines. Bill Ferguson, who's a big advocate and practitioner of transparency in Annapolis, he is more cemented in his position. And there's also some other reform-minded people like Brooke Learman, who are now part of the system. There's some good developments there, but for the most part, it's all people with the same familiar last names.
Except John Carden lost.
Yeah.
So
that's the only non-nepotistic...
there's the exception that proves your rule.
Right. So that's another element of this that bears watching, so hopefully things will change in the future.
Bears watching.
Yeah, or bears...
I just got this visual of like
bears watching.
Yeah, they're watching the polls. They're election watchers. That would scare the bejesus out of everybody, and nobody would...
Right. If you want to see even lower turnout,
fraud,
bears.
No turnout. There'll be no fraud because there'll be no turnout. It'll be a Republican's dream.
Well, you think that's surreal. Have any of you happened by the mouth of the Jones Falls and the Inner Harbor? Because there is a gigantic device that with solar panels that looks like part Conestoga wagon, part paddle boat.
Oh, this is the trash collector?
Yes.
That thing is
part
awesome.
Part spaceship.
Yeah, it's basically scooping up the flow of trash that comes, especially every time it rains, into the Inner Harbor. It's sort of channeled through the Jones Falls. And so there's like a funnel of kind of the same buoys that they use to fight oil spills. And then a solar-powered wheel automatically scoops up the... all of the trash, the Cheetos bags, the
syringes,
what have you.
Powered by syringes.
Yes.
I think it's awesome. I think we should invest in getting another one so we can run races.
That's a whole new element of the kinetic sculpture race.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, I'm actually going to track the people down to this and sue them or something, because I was saying for years that those little paddle boats that you have the tourists go out in. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They should have those double as like trash collectors so we could like harness all this tourism to clean up our bay. And now they've done it on a larger scale. So.
Well, they have the little boats that go around the harbor and scoop up garbage. Mm. They don't let tourists drive those.
Mm. Well, maybe they should. But
they should have races. And then you should have to have a boat that's actually garbage powered to race.
Yeah.
Powered by the garbage that you collect.
The garbage Grand Prix. I think.
Garbage.
Yeah. Yes.
The garb.
It's a green Grand Prix.
Yes. Yes.
That's brilliant. I think the water wheel is great. Fantastic.
Yeah. And I think it's also, this is not something that like the innovation community dreamed up and did because the city was not doing anything. It's actually, from what I understand, there was an individual guy who came up with the idea, but it was entirely with the kind of embrace of the powers that be. So that's one point in the establishment's favor there. That's pretty cool.
The powers that be stole our thunder.
Golf clap all around.
Yeah. It's good. So yeah, and go check it out. And also in the show notes, we'll put a link to a nice NPR story that just ran about this contraption. In other news, Maryland often cites its survey standings as an environment for entrepreneurship and business. Sadly, one of those surveys puts Baltimore down 35th. Maryland.
Yeah.
The state of Maryland is 35th on a list of best states for business. And I think that, there are a lot of programs to help people start stuff, startups, accelerators, incubators, what have you. But it's basically, it's common knowledge that there's a real squeeze once you start to grow in terms of taxation and regulation and flexibility. So, if we're going to be praised on some surveys, we've got to take lumps on other surveys. So something to
monitor. I mean, I think the most alarming part of that study was that Maryland ranked 45th in the cost of doing business. Mm-hmm. So that actually, that's what's really dragging us down. So I think it's something that the state will probably need to address, which of course won't happen till next year. Who's going to address anything at this point? That if we want to have jobs and new businesses here, it can't just be through the people who are just devoted to the state. And so they stay the Kevin Planks of the world or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like there has to be a reason to come here.
Yeah. And, well, there are excuse me, I forgot to press the cough button, but there is a host of reasons why Maryland is a wonderful place to do business and stick around, but the fact is that it is much more expensive than one would think, and I think the only hope for Baltimore in particular and the evolving economy is to be a lot cheaper than other cities on the East Coast. I mean, right now it is, but I mean, when you really think about it, the cheap housing here isn't so cheap unless you're really going on to the urban frontier.
Right.
It's a fragile advantage that.
But I don't think there were in that. This is a CNBC survey that we're talking about. I don't think that the states that they named as leading the way were East Coast states. I think it was like very tipped heavily Southern.
Yeah.
Texas, Georgia, North Carolina. So
it's mostly, I presume, to do with taxation and regulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's businesses are leaving New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Maryland, et cetera, for those states. So I know, and as we'll get into at some point soon, we don't want to be entirely dependent on trickle down from the federal government to keep us going necessarily. Let's see. I'm going to skip down a little bit.
Good thing we were only going to take 10 minutes for
the
news.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's too much interesting stuff. There's a new collaboration that's been announced among universities and colleges and health institutions and the city to foster collaboration among these so-called anchor institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And besides the federal government, these are the institutions that keep our regional economy afloat.
Hopkins University of Maryland.
Mm-hmm. UMBC, or that is University of Maryland. But also, you know, like MICA is a, definitely a major real estate presence in the center of Baltimore. And, you know, all the universities play that kind of role. And they're also talent magnets. So, you know, it'll be interesting. It's the kind of thing perhaps one would think that it had already been happening.
Yes. if one were me. But it's something to keep an eye on. Like, I mean, these organizations obviously should be working together for the betterment of the city, because it if the region improves and grows, then that's better for these institutions. But we'll just...
Yeah, and I think they're starting to get that. I mean, I've been in on some meetings where these ideas have been kicked around with some of these institutions, and I think they realize, I'm assuming their model is places like Boston and the, whatever it's called, the Research Triangle or whatever, where you get this kind of cumulative, mutually reinforcing effect, where if the region improves, it attracts more and more talent. It's like a virtuous cycle. And I think they realize that if they don't start doing these things in more earnest, that they are going to start losing out to the places that have it, that are doing it much better, like Boston, mm-hmm. places in California and so forth.
Yeah. Also, in turning to kind of the along the development lines and turning to kind of a social enterprise angle on that, some people that we know have been involved in a new effort to turn some vacant buildings on Howard Street, once the commercial shopping center of the city. Mm-hmm. They're going to turn a couple, or they're hoping to turn a couple of vacant Howard Street buildings into a theater incubator and a social enterprise impact hub space. And just help to foster a lot of the activity that's happening in that side of town, and provide a home for some, you know, very cool people doing very cool things.
It's brilliant if they can pull it off, because you already have the Hippodrome and Everyman Theater kind of down in that area. So to bring, you know, more early stage theater projects into that same neighborhood, I think is great. And you have the Bromo Seltzer Art District there, and everything about that area can kind of use a leg up. And very often you see that, like, artists and creative people are the leading edge of neighborhood transformation. So if you can do more to bring people down into that area and spend money at Lexington Market, et cetera, there's lots of opportunity to grow.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the overall strategy. And
I think it's banking on culture and on the creative class, which we can have a much, much longer conversation on the merits of one way and the other.
Yeah, that's a whole another can of worms. But podcast. Yeah, but it's an interesting one. You know, and there's a, you know, just a, it is a great part of town. I mean, there's so much beautiful architecture that has been preserved by neglect.
Maybe that should have been the name of the podcast, Andrew.
Preserved by neglect.
Preserved by neglect. Yeah.
Because maybe that's almost like a Baltimore motto. Like, instead of the greatest city in America or Charm City or whatever, preserved by neglect.
Yeah. Oh, all that 19th century charm that you know, H.L. Mencken said, "Let me show you the ruins of a great medieval city." that's our town. A further riff on that theme, Seawall Development, which does a lot of socially conscious real estate development, and a lot of people who have been by Charmington's Coffee have been through one of their venues. Well, they have been expanding in that area and into Remington, and now apparently they are making plans to buy a highly contested site in Remington that was going to be anchored by Walmart. And that had, that generated a lot of strong feelings. Some
people didn't want Walmart, is what.
Well, some did, but a lot of people didn't. And so it will be very interesting to see if it comes to pass that if this kind of socially minded mixed use philosophy of real estate development takes hold instead of Walmart there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Remington, you just feel like that's just an area that's just like ready to just flip. Right, it's so on that I don't know. Is Charmington's in Remington? Everything starts to bleed together. Charles Village around, you know.
I don't know where the line is.
When you have Parts and Labor opening there, I feel like, you're getting pretty posh if you have a Woodbury Kitchen offshoot in your neighborhood.
I always thought of Charmington's as in Remington. I didn't give it much thought, but yeah.
Someone will have to draw us a map.
Yeah. I don't know where are all these boundaries drawn. Is that, there must be an official map somewhere, right?
Probably the best thing is the Neighborhood Indicators Alliance map, which is not census neighborhoods, census designated neighborhoods, and it's not.
Zip code driven, and it's not census tract driven. It is more neighborhood driven. So that'd be a good place.
But
to
how
go
does one decide where one neighborhood starts?
We'll have to have Seema Iyer on to explain to us how they make those decisions. I don't really know.
Putting her down.
Okay. But I do think, you know, there was an article earlier this week. This is not about Baltimore, but there was an article earlier this week in the New York Times about how the Union Square Cafe, which is a pretty upscale Danny Meyer restaurant in New York, is either closing or is definitively relocating out of Union Square because it can't afford the rent anymore in its neighborhood. And it just sort of makes you think about how sometimes, you know, I don't know, like, I think there's a delicate balance in Baltimore to, yes, we want more affluent people coming in because it increases the tax base, which is better for the city. But at the same time, we can't make it totally affluent so that everyone who is middle class is suddenly gone from the city, which is almost the way it is now. Either you're like, you know, you're rich enough to live on the water, or you're too poor to move out of the city. And anything that's in between isn't really here anymore. So there's just a delicate balance to putting, you know, when you put a really posh butcher shop in a neighborhood that is traditionally not very posh, you know, where do those people go? When millennials start moving out of their parents' house because the economy is getting better and getting apartments in the city. This was in the Washington Post today. That watch out, the millennials are coming for your urban apartment. maybe this is just a Washington issue. But, I mean, certainly there's no shortage of housing stock in Baltimore, right?
Well,
if you're willing to take a tree out of your roof,
yeah.
There's a lot of options.
You know, if everybody could participate in something like vacance to values, there would definitely be plenty of housing, but you have to have a certain amount of wealth to even
No one's figured out how to do that at scale, that kind of revitalization using a mechanism like that. I think also the picture of gentrification is not yet clear. There are certain assumptions that come into the conversation that displacement is definitely happening and it's definitely bad. And I mean, but there are some counterindications. I mean, I think it was in the Washington Post a few months ago. There was a story about some research study that, in fact, at least in some instances, the original residents of these neighborhoods are greatly benefited by what would be traditionally be referred to as gentrification. So, you know, I am deeply ambivalent. I have no idea. I definitely think what you're touching on there, Sharon, is really important and really crucial. But I just don't know that anybody has the answer.
I know that Baltimore will not become as pricey as Manhattan in the next year or two. I can say that with confidence.
If ever.
Well, I mean, the thing is that New York has an engine of wealth, right? I mean, it had its bad times in the 70s and the 80s, but it has the financial sector, and that's going to create huge amounts of wealth no matter what. And it's creating this process where the middle class is being pushed out and the poor have already been pushed out. And that's something they're just going to have to find a way to deal with. We'll see how de Blasio deals with that. I think it's going to be interesting. But the main problem with Baltimore at the moment, I mean, I think we're getting these sort of fights over gentrification, but it's a fight between people generally without resources. This is and remains, speaking of The Wire, this is a poor city. And we don't really have an engine of wealth. We could go back to the institutions we talked about before. The closest thing we have is places like Hopkins. They are the largest boys in the state, let alone the city. But nothing like Bethlehem Steel, nothing that provides consistent middle-class jobs for people who don't need lots and lots of higher education. And we do have a huge engine of wealth sitting very close to us. In, you mentioned it, Andrew, in the federal government and in the national security corridor and in the sort of the government contracting IT, DC wealth, you know, ring of suburbs. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know. I can't think of anything else that would be that source of wealth. And I don't know how we connect to that one in any consistent way.
Yeah. It remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, our next topic that we're going to talk about is something that's more on the absurd end of the spectrum. and it is, it's this issue of solving first world problems first, or one of many issues involved. But, a lot of us have been strong cheerleaders for the Baltimore tech startup scene for quite a while. And, you know, it hasn't been as prone to the frothing bubble hysteria of places like San Francisco or Silicon Valley. But, you know, there's a certain shark jumping moment that we may have just passed. And it's a little unfair to single out one company, one group of individuals as an emblem.
But
we're going to do it anyway. so there's this app that you've probably heard of because it's been talked about to a stunning degree, and it's called Haystack, and it's about.
And if you're on Facebook, they obviously have a big ad buy budget on Facebook.
Mm. Yeah, and it's basically about finding parking in Canton, and you pay.
Maybe Federal Hill too.
Well, So you're. I could like fall into all kinds of stereotypes about those neighborhoods that are totally unfair, but the thing is that these are night spots. There are people where these are neighborhoods where young people live, so there's often convenient parking shortages. So to solve this world-shaking problem,
there's an app for that.
There is now an app for that, and it's like a peer-to-peer market for parking spaces.
I mean, you're basically like selling the information that you're leaving your parking space and it is available. And then someone driving around the block looking for a parking space, you know, pays $5 for the information that you're leaving your parking space so that they can drive in and snag it, as opposed to selling the parking space, which is obviously illegal versus like the more morally muddled version that we're looking at where, you know, you can't sell a public parking spot.
Right. Who gets the money?
The person who's leaving the space gets a cut, and so does the app developer, I believe.
That to me is the problem with the system. You eliminate that, and these people could still make money from being an aggregator of information, and everyone signs up, and it's a mutually beneficial system where everyone who signs up pays for the convenience of someone collating that information. It's like, well, how Waze, of course, I assume they're not going to get away with this ultimately, but Waze, the app, has people. You know, alerting each other to the existence of police speed traps, right? And you know, they're not charging for that.
But you don't pay for that app, and you don't get paid for. You get like, you know, meaningless points. You can put like a little hat on your Waze avatar.
I worked really hard to become Waze royalty and have a little crown on my little.
The individuals are not paid, but I mean, Waze. I think it's not
Waze
a pay app yet, but you certainly
no.
Has
it has
ads.
Ad delivery on it, so
right. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't. Personally,
and it's also owned by Google now. So.
Right. Yeah. So they're good for money. but I personally, I'm struggling to see the problem with someone being ingenious enough to come up with a system that aggregates this stuff, and makes some profit off of that. I don't, you know, that the aggregating of public information is a value added. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get angry in a sense in the same concept that like. The people, the companies who you kind of often have to go through to get certain public information, like records and things, because it's like a racket. They get the contract, right? If someone could disrupt that, I think, you know, if I'm going to pay somebody, I'd rather someone who does it efficiently and well. But I mean, the collecting together and the disseminating of public information as a paid service is nothing new, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, yeah. And I think that, you know, in this case, though, it's like it's taking... I mean, I think that's way overstating the significance of what this one app can do. And it's sort of like you have to have the app handy as you're driving around somehow and signal that you need a parking spot. And there has to be somebody at the same moment ready to signal that they are.
So you're saying just logistically, you don't think it's very workable.
People do get desperate enough looking, but I don't think that people leaving parking spots, their first impulse is to, oh, I could get a dollar
for saying that I'm leaving
for waiting
for
this person to come. I don't see that.
But then the market would sort it out on its own.
Yeah, well, that's going to happen.
Because you have similar apps in like San Francisco where the city is, you know, suing now to shut down these mm-hmm. apps saying, is it public information? It's hardly information at all.
Well, it's like, it's basically, what's really happening is that you're being given an opportunity to sell the parking space that you're
in. Again, I think that's both the logistical problem and the ethical problem, because that can lead to trying to game the system and people sort of making what are public parking spaces into a private asset. The information is not, I think, a problem of collating and aggregating that. I don't see an issue with that. And I mean, to your point about the practicality, I have not developed this any kind of app like this, but I would think that if you had a geolocator that knew you were in Canton and then knew that you were on the move once you'd left a space, I can't imagine that'd be that difficult. That would alert mm-hmm. the system automatically if you were signed into it. So again, I can see an app that, like, if you're signed on and pay the $5 a month or whatever for the information service, that would tell you by geolocation where there are now free spots, that could work quite well. And I don't really see a big ethical problem with that. But that's not apparently how this works.
Yeah, it's. I think all of this is. It's. We've already talked way too much about the thing itself, in terms of its ongoing significance. I think because it's just it will vanish in a minute. It's just going to evaporate.
It'll go back into the haystack.
Or it's going to become a gigantic triumph and refloat Baltimore's economy.
But I think this is back to your first point, which is like, solving first world problems first, that there's been a lot of money invested in this, or you have like the even more absurd Yo app. Which has, managed to raise we're talking about millions of dollars here. And in Baltimore, what could we actually be using that money for? And the creativity, the technical know-how that it takes to build these kind of applications, how can we be funneling that into the city to actually improve life for everyone in the city, not just people who can't find parking spaces?
So, this is my gripe, is the more like envy-driven argument, which is that they had this lavish launch party at the Four Seasons Witten Wisdom Tavern.
I would be so happy if I were one of their VCs.
Young ladies with tight white shirts and fake angel wings.
Can everyone see the hairs on the back of my neck stand up when you say that, though?
I mean, it's so classy. It's world class.
It's bro grammar BS.
These parking angels. They're. I don't know what message that sends, really.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. but then for some reason, of all sort of startup launch parties, there's Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger, who I don't think of as a great fan of Baltimore City. He's speaking there. The mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, is there. That for some reason, in addition to the parking angels, they had zombies. And I'm not sure why that is relevant to parking problems, I guess.
Well, clearly because this app is going to raise Baltimore from the dead, right? I mean, that's its potential.
I mean,
it all has religious overtones now.
Yeah, and you look at the website, it's beautiful, and they have like a professionally produced, I guess they're professional actors showing how to use the app in a video.
They have a robust marketing budget. That's what I hear you say.
Well, and it's like, how much do you think like the launch party alone cost? I bet it costs more to put on than having 400 people at Port Discovery last fall for Tech Night. I bet a dollar that's the case.
Because we know how to scrimp and save and turn out a good party.
This is, I guess it's the maximum. Instead of the minimum viable product, it's the maximum noise-generating product. I don't know what to call it.
It's all facade, and there's nothing behind it, really.
I don't know, but
the emperor has no clothes. I'm just going to work a couple of analogies.
It's decadent.
Okay,
it's excessive.
It is.
So what you're saying is Baltimore's not wealthy enough yet to be this decadent.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe in another generation
we can't afford to be this luxurious.
But you know, at the same time, we know people in the tech community here that decry this sort of behavior in the Valley and say, like, look how disgusting it is that this is the way that they would launch a startup. But here they're applauding it. I think there's like a real willingness to, you know, to your point about like, well, why are these politicians there? Because you've got to say like, yay, Baltimore business. Everything that's like Baltimore business is good.
Well, and also we've spent a lot of time trying to get attention for all of the like legit startups, the growing businesses that are happening, that are hiring people, that are making a positive economic and social impact. Mm-hmm. And that's what cheeses me off. It's like, why all this attention for something that, you know, is so inferior to the other cool things that, you know, we've seen around?
Because you have a good publicity person.
But wait, what examples? What are the counterexamples of things that are much more worthwhile?
Well, look at any on-ramp company, if you look at the investment track record of savvy investors, like say John Kamak, who's a ex T. Rowe Price guy who has invested a lot in the ed tech sector, mm-hmm. and like on his LinkedIn profile, you can see what he's invested in, and
yeah, so that's a good example, like something like Common Curriculum.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
That's like, you know, this is a website for teachers to share the curricula that they're building for their classrooms with other teachers. Mm-hmm. That's built by two guys down in Holland's Market.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like that's a really cool idea for a startup. Mm-hmm. That's helping on many levels, but no one's running around talking about how awesome it is. I don't think they would have girls in wings at a party.
Maybe they should.
Yeah, maybe that's what's been missing. Zombies and
right. Robbie and Scott, if you're
and,
listening.
Yeah. I think if you can't beat him, join him. You look at the other ones that like just this is just one example of one savvy investor. There's like Moodle Rooms, which, you know, has actually been bought since he invested in it. Curiosityville also
Just recently
upgraded, yep. Yeah. And SiteLighter, which is kind of a student text sharing thing, if I remember correctly. And there's just a whole bunch of things here. Unbound Concepts, which is a really cool thing about using data tools to determine reading level of writing and text. Anyway, it's like there's some cool things happening, and you know, so why can't they get a little of this spotlight? On that,
because they're too busy building an awesome product, not running around throwing parties for themselves.
Yeah,
that's my very snarky answer. Mm.
Yeah, well, I was being petulant, and you can be snarky, and then
I usually am. That's what I'm good at.
We're way over our intended time, and we've taken a lot of time from Hasdai's schedule. So why don't we just turn to the main reason you're here? Well, first of all, can you tell us a bit about like who you are and what you do in Baltimore?
Sure. So, well, as everyone can tell, I'm originally from Baltimore. No, I'm
say hun at the end of that.
Yeah,
would be totally convincing.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm from London originally. I have a long and complicated history with Baltimore. But I am the founder and CEO of Changing Media, which is a digital media agency that helps mission-driven organizations harness the power of new media for social change. And when you are a digital media agency, you're supposed to have a blog and talk about key performance indicators and search engine optimization, and we're not interested in doing that. We found it boring, as fascinating as it is to work it through with individual clients. So, you know, obviously we're very interested in and involved in social change and social impact initiatives and issues in the city of Baltimore. So we created a blog called Change Engine to kind of focus on that and bring together a kind of platform for social change makers and thinkers and so forth. And we would periodically sort of actually, it's interesting. It's when you get sort of brilliant people together who are doing amazing things, sort of cool things happen and come out of that. And one sort of discussion that kept kicking around is, going back, actually back sort of a little bit to what we were just talking about, is there's been this kind of notion of tech evangelism in Baltimore, and that this will save everything, and that's kind of the publicity campaign. This will bring Baltimore back from, you know, its post-industrial malaise. And one of our columnists said, well, there's some problems with that theory, and it goes back to whether it can really generate jobs and whether the whole digital economy creates jobs for people in the first place in any significant way, and certainly lower income people. And so I sort of said, well, this is a challenge. You know, we talk about we say that's not going to work. So what will work? What is, this kind of a broad discussion. What is the, like, we talk about bringing Baltimore back. What's going to save Baltimore from itself? Like, so we sort of ran this sort of mini sort of Save Baltimore campaign, Save Be More hashtag, social media, right? And so we put it out there, and we got a lot of people to respond and sort of give their pithy one-liners, and also to sort of provide sort of in column length what they thought, and all kinds of ideas and initiatives. Mostly people, it's interesting, a lot of people kind of use this as an excuse to say what was wrong with Baltimore again, and to sell their pet theories. But anyway, I ultimately got into the mix, and one thing that had always been bothering me in this conversation, also in the broader conversation, is kind of this tendency of Baltimore to run from itself and to kind of want to grasp for some identity, whether it's like the greatest city in America or whatever you want to call it, to constantly, in this kind of insecurity, and saying, you know, the Wire gave us this terrible reputation to the outside world. We're never going to attract anyone. No one's ever going to take us seriously. We're never going to come back and revive. We're just going to be associated with this horrible thing, The Wire, which just shows how awful we are. And firstly, this was said mostly by people who had never seen The Wire. It's something I kept noticing in conversation, because if you'd actually seen The Wire, you'd know that, you know, obviously, yes, it paints a very bleak picture, but it's so deep and rich, and it's a love letter in many ways to Baltimore, that it's so much more complex than bad PR. And it also struck me that if we keep running from ourselves, if we keep running from what are legitimately severe social problems and inequities in Baltimore and structural problems, we're never going to recover in the way that these people want. We're always going to be a city that will be haystacks, these sort of sybaritic apps and parties and extreme poverty. And it might seem to those people living in their bubble that Baltimore has come back, but we won't. And I think that ultimately it will be. It is a bubble, and it ultimately is unsustainable. You cannot have a city that is living with such immense inequality, where revitalization means is only for a few. So I wrote a piece where I said we need to embrace The Wire. We need to confront this identity. Not that we sort of exult in this, that we're terrible or anything like that, but the only way to change this story is to acknowledge that this is a significant part of the story, and that the people that we need to empower are both those wretched of the earth that the Wire depicted, and the people among them, and the people from the outside. People like me, who are privileged, relatively speaking, who are coming in, and there are people who are doing much more important work in Baltimore for social impact than me. We need to celebrate and empower those people. We need to, create like a space race for social change, and reward and acknowledge the people who are doing the most for the least well off, not so much the haystacks of the world. And to stop with the embarrassment and the shame, and to own it. We are The Wire. Yeah. We need to own it.
So it's not, we're not The Wire, instead we are X. It's, yes, we're The Wire, but we're also X, Y, and Z.
We can also be, through acknowledging that we are The Wire, and through, we are The Wire, and we acknowledge that that there are these immense challenges, which, by the way, are not our own. I mean, in many ways, Baltimore became a stand-in and a metaphor for the malaise of the post-industrial city in America, right? And if we can solve it here, if we, with all our ingenuity and brilliance and all the untapped social capital and all these places, all this wasted opportunity, if we can turn that around, if we can change that, that I think is a great story. And it comes out of The Wire. It's not running away from The Wire. The Wire energizes it. It electrifies it, so to speak. So that's really, I just sort of put this out there, and it got quite a bit of reaction. So I thought that was quite interesting.
First of all, amen. Second, it sparked a lot of thinking, and it's part of what informs us as we frame this podcast, quoting The Wire, all the pieces matter. But it's in conscious reflection of that theme that you brought up, of like, we need to pull in all of these pieces and build something, that is more enduring and inclusive. I think it's a fantastic, fascinating challenge. And supposedly entrepreneurs are view all problems as opportunities.
Right.
And if that's the case, then we're surrounded by opportunities. and you know, I heard Sarah Heminger, who's one of the, you know, great heroes among change makers in Baltimore, founder of the Incentive Mentoring Program, now known as THRED, which is just had an actually perfect record in bringing the most vulnerable at-risk kids into society and accelerating them through these hardcore mm-hmm. mentorship families. But anyway, like she's been, you know, courted all over the world because of her work, and she's been an Ashoka Fellow, which is for like global social mm-hmm. enterprise all stars, and the thing is that she said is that, well, you know, Baltimore is big enough to have all these problems, but it's small enough where one person can actually make a difference.
Right.
And if you can make a difference in Baltimore with all of our problems, why can't you make it? That means you can make a difference anywhere.
Right. Right.
And
we have one of the heaviest lifts, but we can do it. And I think, again, yeah. sort of the why gives this frame and this common consciousness for people who are trying to create social change. And I mean, if you talk about individual stories, I mean, her story is dead on. But I mean, another great example is Chris Wilson, mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. Is working in various ways for workforce development. I mean, and this is something I didn't know until we all read the Al Jazeera piece recently, and I don't know how Chris would feel about me saying this, but I mean, one could say that his story came straight out of The Wire, I mean, at least conventionally speaking. But mm-hmm. yes, it did, but it also shows exactly, I think, the kind of possibilities and opportunities that we're talking about here, because Chris took this and did, you know, turned it around, did these amazing things. I mean, from incarceration to opportunity and to transforming not only his life, but so many other people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, he brought a lot of people along with him as
Absolutely.
He, you know, turned his life around. And the thing is that, you know, unfortunately, that kind of heroic individual is not something that you can solve all these problems with.
No, of course not.
You know,
right.
It's how do you change the environment so that it doesn't require, you know, near legendary,
sure.
You know, like Frederick Douglass type self-education
right. And I think that's,
to succeed.
That's what we've been wrestling with, I think, already in this conversation before we got onto this topic. It's sort of the question I brought up in what is going to be the engine of wealth and therefore ultimately change. I mean, I think that part of the conversation is removing obstacles, right? So, I mean, one major obstacle, this is one of my issues that I care deeply about in the piece that I wrote was, and I think The Wire spotlighted it beautifully, is the war on drugs. It's mm-hmm. war on drugs policies, it's incarceration policies, mm-hmm. Absolutely devastating communities for absolutely no social, positive social end, absolutely opposite. So reforming those policies, I think, would make a big difference, but there's been so much harm done already. And, you know, you combine that with redlining and racism and so forth. So these are obstacles that have to be eliminated. What alongside that can be that engine of change and wealth, that major, I mean, what we need ultimately in a place like Baltimore, along with the removal of all these obstacles, is more jobs, is more opportunity. And I don't have the answer to that. I don't know if anybody does.
That person should be mayor, though.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, I see, you know, look around Baltimore with the beautiful architecture preserved by neglect, the incredibly talented people, the things that have bubbled up without any initiative or collaboration planning by major institutions, these are so hopeful. Things like everything from like, I mean, it's not to my taste, but like Baltimore club music is world famous. And it's an indigenous cultural product that has been mm-hmm. exported all over the world, and that's something that, you know, is good. We're right here in between all these other much more expensive, pretentious cities. We can get to them if we absolutely have to. You know, we can do things in our own way, and I hear it when like an interview with the band Future Islands that mm-hmm. you know had this, you know, breakthrough performance on the David Letterman show, and they talked about why they're in Baltimore and how it's this. There's this hard work ethic among the arts and culture community here, of you know you got to do it yourself, and it's a working class approach that is attuned to the atmosphere of the city. But it works, and it's helped foster some really creative, you know, visual performing artists coming out of here. Now, they're not going to hire 10,000 people.
Right.
And the people who do find work through that are going to be like people who have spent $40,000 a year to attend MICA, or are in a position to spend a lot of leisure hours perfecting their music. Mm-hmm. So it's not enough. I mean, it's great, but it's not enough. And I mean, that's why I think, you know, there should be a Baltimore love-hate project, because there's the bitter truth and there's also the optimistic truth, and they coexist. And how I don't think we can get anywhere if we don't acknowledge both. And there are people who are just like flippantly anti-Baltimore, mm-hmm. For lots of reasons. And there are people who are mindlessly cheerful about Baltimore, but not that many. But it's having the kind of honest reckoning you talk about. It does seem to be like that first step toward building something that's real.
I think it's essential. And by the way, I love the idea of a Baltimore love-hate project. I think we're all participating in it already.
Yeah.
And for the record, I should note that I lobbied for a long time for the Love Project to at least on April Fool's Day turn their website into the Baltimore Hate Project. But they
how do you make hate out of a silhowette two raised middle fingers? I wonder. that was my idea.
That's your mural.
Yeah. So
I think that would be a very Baltimore attitude if you saw something like that.
Yeah,
that would be indicative to Baltimore of me. Yeah, I mean, I think the reckoning is absolutely crucial, and it may be that the thing that creates what we need, the 10,000 jobs, whatever, hasn't been invented yet, and it's not a model that exists yet, and it can only come through having that reckoning with our problems and with these obstacles that keep so many people downtrodden. That could be. It would be nice. I'm sort of casting around, like, is there a city? Is there something? Is there a place like Baltimore? Not to import, I don't know, you know, whatever sort of fashionable downtown development idea that we always try to do, or the Grand Prix. I see that as another sort of rather silly transplant idea that's going to, you know, it's some theory of bringing people in will create more tax base, which will ultimately, you know, help a few more rich people, I guess. I don't see that as the path of revitalization, but some kind of model, whether it's, you know, workforce development projects in Cleveland, I forget the name of the organization that's mm-hmm. working on that has, it's like a workers collective. And I, again, I don't know if that's the answer or part of the answer. I'm pretty agnostic about the solution, but I think it's what we all need to be focusing on ultimately. First is really coming to a reckoning and not trying to deny what we're facing here, and to, in a sense, take pride in trying to solve it, and then to focus on very specifically on the issue of poverty sort of social determinants of health and, you know, an outcome,
mm-hmm.
inequality.
That's really insightful. Thank you for... No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
I know, I said I would be snarky the whole time, but I'm not.
Yeah, as someone who's like, who considers themselves a champion of snark, I surprise myself when I'm this sincere about something. So, yeah, catch myself saying, what am I saying? Yeah.
Thanks for joining us
today,
Mazdai.
Absolutely, it's my pleasure.
Thank you for having me. Thanks to everyone for joining us on our very first version of this podcast. If you have feedback that you want to give us, we will have a phone number set up shortly. But in the meantime, you can tweet us at allpieces or send us an email at allthepiecespodcast, which is really long, allthepiecespodcast@gmail.com.
And you can also, of course, contact any of us
directly
using the social media. And I'm at Andrew Hazlett, and you are at Sharon_Paley.
Yes, which is very good for podcasting to have an underscore in your Twitter handle. Mm.
It's an emphasis. Just think of it that way. And how can people look up you, Hazdai?
Sure. So Changing Media is Changing Media Group, all one word. I could spell that out, but hopefully I don't need to.
You can spell.
right. And we're also available, we can be reached at Twitter at through the Change Engine blog platform at Change Engine with one E in the middle. So Change Engine. So there you go.
We're building something here, Detective. We're building it from scratch. All the pieces matter.
Baltimore, you're home to me. You're everything a home should be. Love of friends and family.